Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there, this is Kevin Lindsay. I have the honor of getting to co-host Systems and Cybernetics here on the New Books Network, along with my friend Tom Schult. Over the last few months, I have become fascinated about the origins of systems thinking and cybernetics. I've had the great fortune of talking to experts like Magnus Ramage and Martin Reynolds about some of the greatest systems models and systems thinkers of our time. It was my conversation with Tyson Yunkaporta, however, that got me thinking about systems origins that might go back a lot further than 100 years. Who were the original systems thinkers after all? I'm beginning to think everything we have to learn from systems thinking today has its roots in traditional wisdom. In this conversation with Joseph M. Cole about his new book, Buddhist and Taoist Systems Thinking, The Natural Path to Sustainable Transformation, I explored this further. Cole describes this work as a radical new conception of business and management. Since that's the world I come from, I was intrigued to understand, first, what exactly Cole meant by Buddhist and Taoist systems thinking, and second, how it might be an alternative, or at least complementary, to today's business leadership and operational practices. As you'll no doubt tell, I loved this conversation with Joseph, as we explored concepts like the Gaia organization and Zen business model. I left the conversation excited to bring a little business mindfulness back to my day job. I hope you enjoy listening to our conversation and will be inspired to check out the book for yourself. Hi there, this is Kevin Lindsay, co-host of Systems and Cybernetics on the New Books Network. And today I am really thrilled to be in conversation with Joseph M. Cole, author of Buddhist and Taoist Systems Thinking, The Natural Path to Sustainable Transformation. Buddhist and Taoist systems thinking explores a radical new conception of business and management. It is grounded on the reconnection of humans with nature as the new competitive advantage for living organizations and entrepreneurs that aspire to regenerate the economy and drive a positive impact on the planet in the context of the Anthropocene. Joseph Cole is a professor of strategy, sustainability, and innovation at IATA Business School, visiting professor at Yonsei University in South Korea, and research associate at Maastricht School of Management. He works as an independent consultant for a wide range of private and public organizations, such as the European Commission and the United Nations. In the United Nations system, he co-led the first corporate developmental evaluation and adaptive management movement in UNFPA. He regularly speaks internationally on sustainable transformation and coaches organizations, managers, and entrepreneurs in transitioning to the new sustainable, regenerative, and inclusive business paradigm. Joseph lives just outside of Barcelona and has access to nature. He loves to be in the wilds, hiking and enjoying nature and meditating in that environment. He also, in contrast, likes to play the drums and electric guitar, which he also would describe as a meditative practice. So I am really thrilled to have you with me here today. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Thank you so much, and a pleasure to be here. And thank you also for inviting me.
Well, that is my pleasure. And congratulations on the new book. It is just, I think, a couple of months since you launched it. And I have had the opportunity to read it and really dive into it. And I am excited about this conversation. The first question I'd really love to dive into with you is one we always ask on this podcast, which is really, what drew you to systems thinking? How did you get to really where you're at today? Just tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, sure, Kevin. Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to make it short. You know, I was to me, I consider I'm a scientist. I'm also a scientist. I consider myself a scientist, and I wasn't educated under this, you know, this Cartesian paradigm. You know, that based on rationality, you know, linear logic, trying to understand the reality made up of causes of a cause and effect, you know, relationships of cause and effect. And then all of a sudden, I ended up in Asia. You know? I started living in South Korea. And after a couple of 3 years in South Korea, I was very much interested into the original philosophy that was very much ingrained in that part of the world, you know, into Buddhism, into Taoism. And I started practicing Zen. At that time, I was consulting, on international business, especially European businesses that wanted to land in South Korea, also China and Japan. I started my PhD. I started also digging up into international development issues. And I was like separating two fields. No, on one hand, I was doing my job. And on the other hand, you know, I was practicing Zen. The Zen, my entry point to Zen was actually, and for me, Zen is something that I learned there. It's the symbiosis between Buddhism and Taoism, which is very interesting, you know, how they came to get to know each other eventually. You know, after Bodhidharma traveled from India to China, they liked each other. They realized they shared the same principles and they started developing intricately. No, it was like an interwoven relationship between the two. And so I got so much into Zen. To me at that time, I was very stressed. I was suffering from stress. I had even some panic attacks there. And to me, Zen was like, you know, like a moment I had to relax, to calm down. And from there on, I realized that just was only the surface, you know. So I was digging up with the Zen practice, with the meditation, with also reflective meditation, and the two worlds were getting closer and closer. Mm. And until I got like a couple of insights, but one of them was when we were discussing and practicing the concept of oneness, no, which is fundamental in Taoism, but it's always very close to the idea of Buddha, no, which is the connection with that universal wisdom we all have inside, no. And it's curious because there was one way to define human beings that really resonated with me, which my Zen master had a way to say that humans are a small universe, you know, and, right. And as in a small universe, if we pay attention to ourselves, we are going to get the whole information contained in the universe. No? So, and that's actually the primary contribution we later can develop to collective intelligence. So at that point, I was drawn to systems thinking. I didn't know at that point, Kevin, that systems thinking was such a discipline, you know, from a scientific point of view. Mm-hmm. And I came also to realize that actually Taoists were the earliest systems thinkers, you know, which concept I developed in the book. And to me, was I started then, you know, from a scientific, using my scientist together with my system thinker profile, you know, and I saw that there was, you know, a complementary way to look at them, you know, and to make them work together. So from that day on, I decided to bridge these two worlds and also to start applying, you know, this world of more this, let's say, Buddhist and Taoist system thinking to science, to management, to the work I was doing. And well, that the book is the result of this journey, you know, which started, 16 years ago, actually.
Well, and it is very clear as you're reading the book, or as I was reading the book, I felt like I was on that journey with you as you were describing a lot of the ways that you thought about these concepts and applied them in your work, in your consultancy. At one point you describe the book as a toolkit. And I really felt like there was a lot of stuff I could take and apply. And I was really excited to talk to you maybe in another conversation about how I could bring some of these concepts to my work context, my day job, so to speak. One of the things that you introduce us to early in the book, right in your introduction, is this idea of the consciousness gap. And I thought that was a really great way to maybe start this conversation. You describe yourself as coming from that Western model. You were a scientist, you know, you had this Cartesian orientation, and then you were exposed to some of these concepts quite, you know, serendipitously as a result of, you know, your need to really take care of yourself. So as you started to look at the systems that you were in and the ways that science has approached problems and has kind of tackled different issues over time. I'd really love you to talk about that that gap. I mean, you describe an oversimplification, and if I can quote you, you say, systems science does not take into consideration the subjective experience of the observer for healing and transforming the system. So going into this just a little bit more, like what did you specifically see that you really felt could benefit by bringing the Buddhist and Taoist concepts into, I guess, more conventional work, management, etc.?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a good question. For me, the consciousness gap is actually, I would say, the main reason, no, the purpose of this book, no, trying to bridge. Let me also emphasize, Kevin, now that you also give me this opportunity to speak here, that I didn't pretend to write a Buddhist and Taoist scholarly treatise. Mm-hmm. You know, so probably you could get that feeling reading the book, where I'm offering my perspective. No, I mean, this is a universal wisdom, and there are multiple perspectives on that. No, so it's a book written by a practitioner who later thinks, reflects upon this. No, and also theorizes, right, based on experience. So
right.
So based on that, the consciousness gap, as you said, no, there's a risk sometimes also actually system for me is a root word for complexity. No, so we are in a very complex world. Some people call it the VUCA world. No, the others turbulent, mm-hmm. and hyper complexity, different ways, and any way you call it, we have a lot of wicked problems that are contextualized under the Anthropocene, you know, this human-made era that is producing rapid geological, ecological, economic, social changes, you know? And we are the main ones. And this comes because of there's a disconnection between human and nature, although humans are nature. But we somehow, because we are in a cycle, I do this analogy, you know, in Buddhism says that there's the cycle, we are tracking the cycle of samsara, no, which is the cycle of birth and death.
Right.
So a little bit, we are trapped in the cycle of production and consumption. No? So we are socially organized around the idea of work, you know, to be productive, you know, and so that we have a way of living. No, and so we earn our salaries, and based on that, then we have developed also a leisure culture, which is based on around the idea of consumption. So by pursuing this, we certainly disconnected, you know, from our true nature. So to meet a consciousness gap, when we approach the problems we have, which are complex, those problems are approached through a scientific lens, which does not integrate the feelings of the observer. And to me, that's essential. And so the observer has a consciousness, no? Any participator and any observer is a change maker. So as such, it has the opportunity to influence the system in any way. Even doing nothing is a way to influence the system in which we live, no? So yes. To me, that was a revelation, a huge revelation, Kevin. So to me, and just to end up with this, bringing Buddhism and Taoism offer us a way to liberate from this cycle and to upgrade our level of consciousness so that we also can be an active change maker, so a true source for transforming the systems we operate in.
Thank you for that. And, you know, I that was really an important takeaway for me early in the book. I was looking for how do I think about this in the context of systems and cybernetics. And, you know, as we know in second order systems thinking, you know, we put the observer right in that system. And I guess it kind of struck me was maybe we're doing that, but that observer is unprepared or doesn't necessarily have the tools to be a participant. And so what struck me was just that, you know, a lot of the concepts that you talk about maybe and better enable us to, you know, have that, you know, impact to be able to make those decisions that you talk about in the book more effectively by tuning in and at a slightly different level. you know, I appreciate that you said that this is not a scholarly piece on Buddhism, Taoism, but I think it might be kind of important at this point for listeners who might be less familiar with these practices and these traditions to maybe just give a little bit of a primer on some of the principles that kind of run through the book. There were quite a number of them. I'll leave them to you to decide which ones you feel are maybe most important to bring up right now in this conversation. But I appreciated that you just mentioned samsara right now, and that was a concept that was new to me. And so there are a few of these that I felt like are quite important. Could you maybe just talk about a few of those that you feel they run through the book and it's kind of important for people to understand them a bit?
Yeah, definitely. I will start by one, to me, that's the central principle, and which is the one which maybe is entering also the organizational management lexicon, and that's interdependence. Mm-hmm. And I said that because I saw the B Corp movement, you know, that is speaking about interdependence. So by interdependence is the principle that, you know, everything is connected and everything is related. That's one thing. But behind that, to grasp, you know, one thing is to theoretically, intellectually, you know, think about, understand that, no, that everything is interconnecting. Some people may say that's obvious. The other thing is feel the interconnection. And here is where the complexity comes in. You know, for example, no, I have the assumption that if we feel that we are part of the world, we are likely to treat it better. And somehow we are still part of a socioeconomic system, you know, which is extractive by nature, you know, that exploits human and natural resources, you know, in exchange of a profit. So we are so much disconnected, and somehow feeling we are part of nature, feeling the interdependence among all the elements that set up our systems, to me, that's one of the main principles that are shared between Taoism and Buddhism. And then here I will introduce two other principles which are closely related. Huh? So one is the principle of emptiness. Mm-hmm. Emptiness, which the word in English, I don't think combis, you know, the original term in Chinese or even Sanskrit, right? But emptiness means being empty of a separate self, which is impossible, so we are full of everything, no? And I'm here paraphrasing the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, who has a beautiful book that explains the concept of interdependence and emptiness through a word that he calls interbeing, no? The Master Hanh says, we interbe, no? And mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more, you know? But for getting to feel the interdependence, it's very important that we practice emptiness, which is a process in which we detach from our egos. We are very much dominated by our egos because the socioeconomic system puts a lot of pressure on us to find an identity since very early on, you know, in our childhood, where we are from, the things you like, you know, where do you study, where do you work, which networks you empathize with, which football club you support, you know what I mean? So race, gender, we are very much put under a lot of pressure, you know, to define ourselves in relation to identities. So, and here we are inflating our egos, no? When you have to sell your talent, if you're looking for a job, or if you are selling your own entrepreneurial skills and professional talent to others. So we have first to start thinking what differentiates us from others. So this is a process of separation, right?
Right.
So our identity, our pressure to, you know, define our identities is what really separated us from the interdependence principle. So now we have to unlearn this thing by practicing emptiness. And to practice emptiness, we need to suspend our, not our feeling, but our judgment for a second, so that we can connect deeply with what really unites us all, which is the fundamental universal value, which is love, which is compassion, which is the desire to be happy. You can go everywhere, different cultures, different people, you know, different identities. And this is the common thread, no, that unites us as humans. What is different is the different ways to arrive to that place, no, where we feel, let's say, happy or harmonious or peaceful, no, different ways of saying that. But I think the audience will grasp, no, that the meaning when we feel really quiet and healthy and peaceful and in peace with ourselves. So that would be the principle of emptiness, which is the entry point to feeling the interdependence of all things. And then it comes the fundamental one, which is oneness. It's also it symbolizes or reflects the essence of the Tao. No, the Tao is the thing that cannot be named. So we are talking right now, Kevin, about an idea of Taoism. No, we cannot talk about the Tao. It's something Lao Tzu says in the Tao Te Ching. No, so we are talking about the idea of the Tao, which is different. No, but we love talking about that because it's a way that makes us, more empowered to walk this way and start this journey. So oneness would be those insightful moments where we feel part of everything. You know, when we look at ourselves and we say, "Oh my God, we are everything." No, we are that small universe. And then when we look outside ourselves, we feel so small because we are part of something which is huge. No? So that would be the principle of oneness, intricated with interdependence and emptiness, which for me are the three fundamental principles that are shared between Taoism and Buddhism.
I love that. And, you know, I wish I'd been with you when you had this, like, oh my God, epiphany when you went, these were the earliest systems thinkers, by God. You know, all of these concepts are so important. I had the opportunity to talk to Tyson Yunkaporta, who is the author of Sand Talk, a little while ago. And I came out of that conversation going, wow, those elders that he's talking about, they were the original systems thinkers. So what it just tells me is that the wise elders, the indigenous wisdom, the ancient wisdoms, from thousands of years ago, they understood this stuff. Like, they really understood what it takes. And it's only in the last few hundred years that somehow this has gotten lost in many cultures and particularly in the West. So, I love that. And I think that's a really good foundation. I really appreciate that you helped us kind of level set on these concepts. As we go into the discussion, you spend the majority of the book talking about how these principles can be applied and used in business as part of transformation. And, it's also interesting because I think you do a really good job of making it, it's easy to understand that any kind of organization, such as, the one I work for, can be, a purpose-driven organization. And when you align that orientation with how you do the day-to-day and execute in your business, you really can achieve some of these sort of higher-level aspirations I think you outline so nicely in the book. And I'd like to get into that. You've got some really practical, interesting ideas, but let's just first talk about the emergence of a new business paradigm. You really kind of propose that there are ways, something that you, some work that you've done around the Zen business model over the years that really, it's so clear you've had some really interesting interactions with businesses and organizations and experience sort of bringing this. And I'm really curious, and I think the listeners would be also curious to really get a picture from you on what that looks like and some of the response that you've had to these principles.
Thank you for the question. Let me start by saying that the new business paradigm, that's why I call it in the book, is emerging. No, it's something that it is shaping, and I think that's important. No, so it's I think we are in a kind of interregnum. No, with all ways of doing, all ways of thinking are dying, and new ways of doing, new ways of thinking are getting born. but we still, you know, we still don't see the face, how those new ways look like. So that creates a lot of uncertainty, because we are normally accustomed, you know, we are used to do the things we are taught, right? So, and to see the things as they look like. So we are living away, and I think that has been accelerated, you know, that feeling with the COVID pandemic. So in which it's very, uncertainty is everywhere. So sometimes I think that everyone listening will resonate with the fact that sometimes, you know, we want data to make decisions, but sometimes we don't have data and we still have to make decisions. And sometimes we even have contradictory evidence, you know, and yet we have to make decisions, right?
Right.
So I think I'd like to frame, you know, the emergence of this new business paradigm in that transition, in that interregnum. So you're going to see companies that are still doing the old ways, that still see a company following an organization as a machine metaphor, no? Which was an understanding that was very much entered by Frederick Taylor at the beginning of the 20th century, you know. So, and this is actually, I studied business administration and management in the 90s, and I actually got this, you know, from my teachers and professors.
Yeah, Taylorism.
Exactly. And I went to work, I went to the industries, you know, with this mindset, you know.
Right.
But then you start realizing that there's a new business paradigm that bring other principles, you know. And one of them, for example, is seeing the organization as a living system. Why? Because it's shaped, it's made by humans, by human beings that are alive. So when you look at an organization as a living system, as a living organization, you can no longer keep working under the same premises. So the emergence of the new business paradigm is not something new. It's emerging since the 60s. So that information is already there. It started specifically with the countercultural revolution in the 60s, actually in the US, and then it's been you know, evolving until now. So the information we have is not new. What is new is that more and more people are having this information, and in different sectors, in different realms, you know. And 100 years ago, the way we had to evolve, because this is not the first change of paradigm we live, it's the 8th one. So the changes of paradigm, or paradigm shifts, as Thomas Kuhn calls them, this one is different, because this one is shaped by a lot of people. So it's all the masses, it's us who have the responsibility, who are becoming enlightened, and let me use this Zen word, you know,
right?
And who decide to take action. Before, it was like the knowledge of a guru, no, that was followed by the masses, but the power, you know, was residing in the hands of very few people. And now it's the power is decentralized across the network, which is different. So I think that's an important feature of this new business paradigm.
Yeah, and, you know, in that chapter, which you call Tao 4.0, it's a great chapter. And, you know, I read it a couple of times. For me, in the organization where I spend most of my time, in the industry where I've spent 25 years, we really pride ourselves on being a data-driven organization. You know, we make our decisions based on a, you know, data-driven operating model, DDOM, we call it. And, you know, you talk about that ability or capacity to gather and organize information based on data and evidence. And yeah, I'm all about that. But really, how do we balance that with that intuitive knowledge in an interactive and synergetic fashion? It feels like there's it's a little bit taboo, isn't it, in many organizations, going on gut feel, or I don't know, just a hunch, or insights that don't come from the data or the models or our dashboards are not so welcome in many organizations. So and in the book you do say this is emerging. This is something that isn't necessarily going to resonate with some organizations. What have you seen in terms of willingness to sort of bring in perhaps other ways of knowing into decision making. A concept that you do also introduce us to in the book is Wu Wei. Mm-hmm. So you know, maybe talk a little bit about that and explore my question.
Yeah, definitely. Great question. And this is something, you know, Kevin, I suffer every day because I'm, for example, I'm, let me introduce this with an example. Okay. So I one of my main clients is the United Nations and I'm colleaguing with a colleague of mine, a process of change of transforming the management system there in one of the agencies. And actually, you know, UN is an evidence-based organization, so it's data-driven and indeed, you know, is very accountable to the donors and also the beneficiaries, you know, at all levels. So they just created a resource-based management system in which decisions are driven by data, but they find a problem, which is sometimes data is not available and they still have to make decisions. So how do we do from that point on? So knowledge creation has different sources of information. So one is data, and of course, I love data, but sometimes it's not enough. So we have to set up in place mechanisms in which people are empowered, you know, to sense the information, to sense what is in here, to grasp the context. So we have, for example, a tool we developed, which is called Context Aware Monitoring, in order to monitor how programs are implemented. We need also insightful based and pause and reflect practices that put us in a way in which we reflect about how we perceive the reality, what's going on. So, and this is an Eastern philosophy, Eastern wisdom in this case, Buddhist and Taoist systems thinking can really help us a lot by bringing techniques like meditation, like mindfulness, but practice in a very genuine way. Right. Purpose-driven practices that may help us enter into a space in which we can design emerging futures. So we can no longer learn from the past. No, this is the realm of data. Data actually is it tries to develop patterns, you know, but from the past and sometimes for in the realm, in the domain of transformation, Kevin, we need to learn from the future. And for that particular reason, the tacit knowledge, personal knowledge, you know, which is very important, which is the root of all knowledge, is something we should develop. And we somehow disconnected from that because of Taylorism and this Cartesian paradigm in which we are educated, you know?
Yeah. I love that. And, you know, you talk about the quest for balance and harmony in this regard. And, And you talk about something that most of us, you know, if we've heard anything in the past and haven't had our head in the ground, we've probably heard of yin yang, and the yin yang theory. You talk about yin yang interactive patterns explain the behavior of the whole as a self-regulating system, and so it sort of feels like, you know, that you know, female, male, yin yang kind of balance in the decision making, in how we operate and how we bring up this, I guess, the data and the kind of intuition. And so I'm still trying to, you know, you can tell I'm someone who's going, you know, after we're done this conversation, I'm going to, you know, engage in some other work where I'm really looking for tips on how I can strike this balance in my work. So I'd love you to just chat about that. You know, you do talk about some of these concepts like paradox and complexity, and maybe some of these things are okay in terms of dealing with some of these contradictions.
Yes, definitely. No, I mean, complexity is about that. Is about paradox and contradictions. So we see one thing one way, and another person sees the same thing a different way, and no one is mistaken. there are different perspectives, you know, and different ways to understand the same reality. And that's fine. That's we are operating under complexity here, no? But the yin and yang, as like the Zen business model, those systemic methodologies, they offer, I like calling them simplex ways of navigating mm-hmm. complexity. Simplex, why? Because they are complex. But we can no longer just keep diving into complexity. We need ways, you know, to navigate complexity and to some extent even to get out of complexity, at least for some time.
Yes.
You know, or at least to have our minds, you know, at least that they have like a clear sense that, well, this is the direction and that makes sense, at least that, no? So one way is the yin-yang. I developed a concept which is called the yin-yang creative tensions, which is mm-hmm. Because the yin-yang is actually, it's a duality that by understanding the duality allows you to transcend the duality, no? So that every phenomenon can be expressed in two different ways, no? The yin and the yang, no? As you mentioned, the female and the male, the sun and the moon, no? The night and the day. So in business, for example, in organizational management, we find a lot of phenomenons that can illuminate the opposite, no? So for example, one way, and this is something I see countless times with my clients, no? And a couple of weeks ago, we had a conversation. We started with a yin-yang creative tension because they, it was a company that didn't know how to actually, which purpose had to pursue, rather profitability or sustainability. So and there were differing perspectives in the company. So in the same organizations, people said, no, we have to make sure that the company is profitable first. And then if we are financially healthy, then we have to devote part of the profit, you know, to set up sustainable practices in the company. And this is a mental model, which is quite predominant today in companies that have already started transitioning towards sustainability. But there was also some inside the perspective who said, no, we have to be sustainable. Our main purpose has to be sustainable. And we have to design new business model that fits sustainability. Mm-hmm. So you can see here the two polarities, right? So when you have illuminated the two polarities, the transformation happens between those two polarities. So that's the right space for transformation. And this is extremely creative for organizations. This is extremely mm-hmm. transformative. And it's one of the ways we could apply this concept in organizational management.
Right. I love that model. And listeners are going to have to obviously look at the book, purchase the book and read the book to see the illustrations and diagrams that you have in here. But yeah, I really appreciated the polarities that you talk about. And for example, different kinds of beneficiaries. And I know, you know, over the years, we've grappled in business with, you know, customer first, shareholder results, all of those kinds of things. So the company that has, you know, this nice funding runway to kind of just be, you know, spending like crazy, and then they go public and all of a sudden they have to tighten the purse strings and customer satisfaction suffers as a result, because again, they're having to look at profitability and shareholder return versus the customer experience. And so there's so much of this that really applies to any kind of organization, whether, you know, profit or nonprofit. You also bring an interesting theory, and this is one that I really was loving. And this was the five elements and how we can bring this sort of idea of the five elements into business. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I love it. Well, yes. The five elements. No, the five elements or the five transitioning energies. No, we call it the five elements, but maybe a more exact, precise translation is the Wuxing. No, the five transitioning energy. It's a theory, a well-known theory in some domains, scientific domains and disciplines. Like, for example, it's the basis for traditional Chinese medicine. It's been applied to geobiology, also, and to martial arts, you know? And what I do here is actually bringing this theory, and I make the analogy and the contribution to apply it to organizational development. So that's my contribution. I coined this methodology, the Zen business model, but it's actually based on these five elements. And to me, and what I saw practicing this in organizations, is that actually it's a way to mimicking, you know, the cycles of transformation of nature. So in a way, Kevin is like, hey, let's learn from nature and let's apply the natural cycles of transformation into our organization. And that's why it resonates so well into how organizations may develop, because it's actually how we humans develop along, you know? So it has the five elements are converted into five corporate stars, which keep are built based on the main principle behind each element. And they follow, you know, for having a system, you need the elements, you need the interconnections and the purpose, right? So they follow two cycles, two relationships between the elements. One is the cycle of generation. It's the generation of value. So it helps you understand how an organization generates and adds value. And the other one is also the control cycle. Sometimes when you have one corporate star, one area or process in the organization, which you have it in excess, that can also be quite damaging for other aspects in the organization. So you have a systemic overview on how the organization works. And that gives you not only a diagnosis of how your organization is performing or can be in a certain moment in time, but also give you a roadmap on the interventions that you should apply if you want actually, you know, to develop your organization in terms of sustainability, of regeneration. So it's a pretty cool model that is very practical, I think.
Yeah. You know, I could see you know, certain corporate types, if I may use that term, kind of like, wait a minute, this is pretty far out. But when you start looking at like how, you know, these ideas of fire is about knowledge, earth about social relations, and so on. You talk about the balance and use the term systems disequilibrium. That it's very, you know, it's very easy, I think, for organizations to fall into that disequilibrium, and, you know, understanding kind of like where you're a little bit out of whack, because it can change over time. Like most of the time, you know, any organization, they say, okay, this is our problem. Like we're doing too much or too little of this. And we swing 180 degrees the other direction and kind of overcompensate. And so I think just kind of finding that balance. I think that listeners who are interested in this area and, you know, who work within organizations where, you know, you're managing a lot of different demands and stakeholder expectations and a lot of different KPIs should really look at this model. It's very interesting. Something that also runs throughout this portion of the book, where at least it really hit home for me, you bring up the idea of abundance a fair bit. It's a theme that I noted. You know, there's we really need to have this. I think within which star was it that, you know, the abundance mindset was really important to water, like the element water, and full profit, like this whole idea of full profit. But you also talk about abundance in a slightly different concept. Sorry, I'm like dropping your book. No disrespect intended.
No problem.
But you say managing abundance requires a systemic approach to understanding the dynamics of the economic system and identifying those leverage points that you talked about. So spend a few minutes talking about this abundance mindset, because I think that most of us run around with quite the opposite. You know, we have this scarcity mindset, not enough of this and not enough of that. So that's what informs our actions.
Definitely. Well, it's actually quite a rather complex concept, no abundance, and it's a concept I permanently, you know, think about it, you know. And to me, going to Buddhism and Taoism really helped me trying to understand the meaning of the concept, because when we hear for the first time abundance, no, we associate it to economic abundance, no, and economic abundance automatically is associated to what you said, no, to scarcity. I mean, we compete for resources. We compete for talent. We compete for this piece of the market. You know, we are competing for everything. We are at the school. We play basketball. We love basketball, but it's all about competition, and we get that. No, so, so we are so much, you know, immersed in scarcity at all levels. So that when we hear the word abundance, is like, oh, having a lot of material stuff, and that's actually. Something that Buddhism and Taoism actually turns it upside down and says, no, actually you feel abundant when you are detached from material stuff, no? So, and then, but then you deep dive a little bit more on the concept, and you find the framework which I described in the book, which abundance for Taoist and Buddhist is what it stays at the intersection between space, time, and ourselves, no, being. So being is contextualized under a particular place where we live, right, and also in a particular time. So and here the first questions we ask ourselves is, how do we want to live? How do we want to be in that space and in that time? And for example, one of the most scarce resources we have is time, right? Especially, I mean, work consumes most part of our time. So our available time without sleeping and eating, I mean, it's probably, we spend like 70-75% of our time working or commuting to work. And so that really conditions how we live. So if you don't do something you really like, you feel really scarce. So having an abundance mindset happens for actually starting as a self-assessment process, no, a reflective process in which you ask yourself, how do I want to be here and now? And to me, that's a starting point. And you look at Buddhism and Taoism, and you see that time is a wider concept. And life, it's not just the lifetime. It's not just the available time you spend here in this life, you know, but it also transcends the physical boundaries we have, no, which are seen through our bodies. So it's a very interesting concept. And when you approach, and for companies, and now let me talk about this, when you actually, but this is a personal exercise one has to do. So I recommend to do that for leaders, no, leaders that lead organizations, that managers, or for professionals, no, because that changes how you also manage your business, because then you no longer talk about the quantity of economic growth you need, but then you realize that what your company needs or what you need is to qualify economic growth and to make it compatible, you know, what the feelings you went through when you were feeling this abundance in this wider sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's a very interesting concept. It's an evolving concept, but definitely Buddhism and Taoism have inquired about that concept since long, long time ago. And I think we can learn so much from them.
And to me, it feels like it takes a lot of discipline. I think that our go-to in business and in our personal lives is probably, for most of us, for me anyway, not abundance. It's, what am I missing? What do I don't have yet? You know, what's tomorrow going to look like? Because maybe I'll be able to fill my cup then. And you know, when I start thinking about, as I, you know, start to do 2022 planning with my team, what would it look like if I approached it from a place of abundance? Like, hey, what do we have in abundance? What is it that really we have to, you know, that can drive the business that we've got, that is just, you know, rather than what are we missing? Where are we not, you know, meeting our goals, etc. It could be really interesting to explore that.
Definitely. I fully agree.
So as we start to wrap up the conversation here, the last chapter is called Business Mindfulness. And you've mentioned mindfulness a little bit in the conversation, and it's obviously a term that's thrown around a lot. these days. And, you know, there are mindfulness apps. In fact, I think I've got a couple of them on my phone. They're in need of severe updating because I probably haven't opened them in a year. But I'd love you to just talk about that a little bit. You write that it's the for businesses, it's that cognitive process by which the organization becomes aware of the impacts generated by its activities, positive and negative, intended and unintended, and internal and external to the organization. And I kind of went, wow. I mean, all right, that's a different, slightly different take on mindfulness. And it actually makes it quite real, something that organizations could engage in. I'm not sure it's something that, you know, the Headspace app would necessarily prompt me to do. But I'd love you to just spend some of our concluding moments here talking about business mindfulness.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Kevin. Yes, we are used, no, and it was also my entry point to mindfulness. I was looking for a Mac mindfulness, you know, for an easy technique that could help me, you know, navigate and manage all those shortcomings I was experiencing, and it really worked. But as long as you keep digging upon mindfulness, you realize that the original practice is not detached from a deep reflection on what are the consequences of our actions. That personal level. If you apply this to an organization that wishes to create a positive impact, you know, in the community, in the ecosystem, in the world, so that organization automatically has to start asking the questions: Am I actually achieving my purpose? Am I actually, you know, producing positive results based on, you know, my purpose, my business activities, my business operations, and how can I know? So business mindfulness is actually the concept behind engaging into a process of evaluation in which you ask those right questions and you also measure, you know, the impact you are having on your stakeholders based upon the purpose that you have. So the purpose is a way, you know, you clearly state your intentions. But and this is one problem we have, that a lot of companies have a purpose, but few companies know how to actually walk the talk. So that's called the purpose gap. And one way to bridge the purpose gap is actually evaluating whether your purpose has been accomplished or not. And business mindfulness actually helps us in putting the attention on those outcomes, and not only the outcomes, but also the process. Because if we change our purpose, but we are still looking at the same KPIs, how are we going to learn out of this process of transformation? So business mindfulness puts the lenses towards evaluating and measuring intended impacts, also non-intended, and this can be positive and negative, and internal and external. So I think that companies that really state that they are going towards the new sustainable business paradigm, that they are embracing the transition towards sustainability or regeneration and inclusivity, those companies need solid, rigorous business mindfulness processes, evaluation processes, in which you don't only measure the impact, but you evaluate and learn out of it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you so much for that. I think that's a great way to end our conversation. It's been fantastic. I think that all kinds of listeners are going to benefit from hearing your words, and also from reading your book. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. I wish we could just continue, and maybe we can. Offline, we'll find a way. So thank you so much for talking with me, Joseph.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for this opportunity. I really enjoyed this talk. Thank you for your questions, and greetings to everyone.
Thank you. You've been listening to my conversation with Joseph M. Cole, author of the new book, Buddhist and Taoist Systems Thinking, The Natural Path to Sustainable Transformation. This is Kevin Lindsay, co-host of Systems and Cybernetics. And until next time, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.